HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 207, recorded live Thursday, March 18, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with developer and author Charles Petzold about the Windows Phone 7 series.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and I'm here at Mix in Las Vegas at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino, and I'm talking today with legendary author Charles Petzold, who has been so kind to sit down with me as I run to the airport. How are you, sir?
Great. I'm great.
I was thrilled to see you here, and I noticed that you're actually wearing a shirt that says Programming Windows Phone 7 series.
Yes, it's a new book. This is why I'm feeling so great. I am doing something I love doing most of all, which is writing a book. And it's about the new Windows Phone. And they're really using this week, Microsoft is using Mix to tell us for the first time, tell the public how you write apps for the Windows Phone. And that's cool.
Now, for those of the audience that may not be as old as I am or may not have been doing Windows since before Windows 3.1, tell us a little bit about the seminal book that you wrote and you know, how that... What did you write that people know you for, sir?
Back in 1987, I began writing a book that was eventually called Programming Windows. And this was not the first, but one of the very first books about how to write apps for Windows. When I began writing the book, I was targeting Windows 1.0. By the time I finished the book, I was targeting Windows 2.0. I started getting beta versions about halfway through writing the book. Mm-hmm. And they changed some of the screen and layout paradigms. So I had to go back and fix things, as I've had that experience in writing books ever since. Mm-hmm. That book was published in 1988, targeting Windows 2.0. Mm-hmm. The sales were slow. And then in the early 90s, it went through two more editions for Windows 3.0 and Windows 3.1. And those are the editions that people really know about. To this day, people come up to me and say, I learned Windows 3.0 from your book and 3.1 from your book. So there was a later edition for Windows 95 and then Windows 98. And that's that fifth edition, published over 10 years ago, is still in print.
Really?
Really. I'm still earning some royalties from it. I still get email from readers, mostly outside of the U.S. at this point,
mm-hmm.
still doing Win32 API programming, which is something I haven't done for 10 years.
Yeah. Do you consider yourself a technologist or an author?
I like to think of myself as an author with a technology and math background. I've written 15 books, I think. I think the total is 15. The two books I'm proudest of are, the first is entitled Code, The Hidden Language of Computer Hardware and Software,
mm-hmm.
Which is about, it's basically a how computers work book, how computers work, but it's, unique.
If I can actually stop you, because I wanted to bring up Code and I'm thrilled. Code is one of my and I know I realize that the audience will realize that I'm, of course, of a Charles Petzold fanboy, but in all seriousness, I started writing a book called Computer Zen a number of years ago, and I had the audience imagine a 2x4 of wood and put light bulbs on it, and then someone said, this book has been written already. I wrote about 4 chapters, and it's called Code by Charles Petzold, and I actually read that book, and I've given it as gifts. I've used it as a teaching syllabus in universities. It's just a phenomenal book that takes you from the bit to the microprocessor.
Thank you.
It's really one of my favorite books, and I encourage people to check it out.
Thank you.
And it has a particularly innovative cover, because it has the word code in Morse code
and Braille. Yes.
And it's a great book. I'm glad. I'm thrilled that you're as proud of it as I much enjoyed reading it.
In the first few chapters, I use Morse code and Braille as two examples of binary codes that mm-hmm. preceded computers by a good 100 years, I guess.
So 15 books.
And the other one I'm proudest of is the Annotated Turing, which came out last year. And it's takes Turing's seminal paper on computability that mm-hmm. he wrote as a graduate student in 1936 and annotates the hell out of it. Because the paper itself is only about 40 pages, less than 40 pages total. And I provide a lot of background to reading the paper. The paper is not easy to read. It uses a lot of weird symbols. You need to know a little background of why he wrote this paper. But Turing was attempting to solve a mathematical problem that was posed by David Hilbert. And in so doing, he invented a computer, an imaginary computer, that can process just a very tiny number of instructions, and yet has since been proven to be equivalent to the biggest supercomputer, except not quite as fast.
One of the things that I like about your books, and one of the reasons that I wanted to interview, was that I've always felt when I was teaching in university, and then when I do, I guess you could call it teaching, but these little 1 hour and 90 minute talks, that the sense of historical context is so often missing from both technical presentations and from technical material, that everyone thinks that they've invented something new and amazing. And in all of your books, there's a narrative that I think kind of respects the way we've come from and where we're going. I wonder if that's intentional.
Yes, I like history. I've enjoyed history since I was in high school, and I particularly am intrigued by what's commonly referred to as the prehistory of computing. The most obvious is Charles Babbage in the 19th century, who designed something that if it were built, it would be probably the most impressive technological feat of the 19th century. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. it was never built. But also things like the invention of logarithms and some analog computers that are very interesting historically that predated digital computers. There was a machine that was built by Vannevar Bush called the differential analyzer, which basically solved differential equations, but did so using a bunch of pulleys and wheels and stuff. And it's just amazing. There's actually, you can see a little glimpse of the differential analyzer in a, I don't have the title of it. There's a science fiction film from the early 50s that...
So it really existed. They built it.
Yeah. This was built in the 1920s at Harvard. I may have all my details wrong. Mm-hmm. Or MIT.
Don't worry. Our readers will correct your... yes. And we'll make sure that we put links in the show notes.
All right. This was used a great deal for solving differential equations.
As I get older, as I approach 40, I'm starting to feel like, and I always refer to this kind of archetype as the old guy with the beard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're a programmer, you have to get that good beard going, before you can really get the big money.
Just like the 19th century scientists.
Yeah, exactly. Until you've got a long white beard, they won't respect you when you go to Parliament and make your proclamation. Is this because of an increased sense of, I've seen this before that I'm feeling? Am I getting a sense of deja vu that is causing me to become cynical? As someone like you who've seen it from the very beginning to now, are you cynical or excited?
It's in theory, I should be very cynical about all this stuff. But by the time .NET was introduced, which I guess I first started fooling around with it in the year 2000, does that sound right? I was pretty tired of API programming.
Mm.
And I really welcomed a good object-oriented interface to Windows. You might be thinking, what about MFC? Well, I never really got into MFC. And one reason why is that I didn't particularly like C++ as a language. It always looked ugly and clunky to me. And because it was basically glommed onto C, which was always to me a very elegant language. And MFC also itself seemed to be a very light wrapper on the API. I really couldn't see a big advantage to MFC at that time. I liked WinForms, Windows Forms, which was introduced in .NET 1.0, a lot better. And then when I started seeing the betas of what became Windows Presentation Foundation, I liked that a lot. And I think that to me, WPF is industrial strength Windows programming. So,
but two questions about WPF and that. One is, when I first saw XAML, I said, "Oh, it's resource files again."
resource files on steroids.
Yeah,
yes.
Except they're more verbose, right?
Yes.
And then my second question is, why is it so hard to learn? Why is it the number? Is it concept count, or is it that we haven't found the right narrative?
Is XAML the hard to learn?
Just sitting down and busting out XAML. I remember the first time I tried to learn HTML tables. I think I spent about 3 days, and then one day it clicked, and now I can make a table with a call span with the best of them. Of course, that's no longer a useful skill. Now it's something else.
I think XAML is somewhat similar in that respect. There are some, conceptual and syntactical oddities of XAML. I'm thinking of property element syntax, where you define if a property cannot be expressed, if the value of a property cannot be expressed in a text string, you need to break out the property as a property element as separate tags and then define the property like so. I remember my pain and confusion in encountering this syntax for the first time. So when I'm writing about XAML, I take special care to discuss this syntax, to point it out, how weird it is, how it almost looks like an extension to XML, and it's really not.
XAML seems very kind of verbose, but we haven't created a designer yet, although maybe Blend is getting close, that we can truly hide it. It feels like when we did front page in HTML, you know, you could tell when someone wrote their HTML with a designer.
It's, to me, XAML is not verbose, because if you put XAML side by side with the equivalent C sharp code, that XAML is shorter.
Yeah.
And in almost all the cases, even with the C sharp is getting close with the new syntax where you can use angle brackets and define the properties when you're constructing an object. But the XAML is usually more concise. I have all of the XAML that I have published in books and articles, I've handwritten. I am one of these people who is extremely reluctant to have tools, even Visual Studio, generate XAML for me. So I have not come across a good way of teaching people how to program by pulling controls over onto the surface of a window. That to me is not programming. I want to focus on the syntax, and I want to get programmers accustomed to writing this stuff for themselves. So when they eventually go to Expression Blend, which they will, I have no doubt of that, they'll at least understand what it's generating. Also, I do a little consulting. Unfortunately, I do more consulting these days than I have needed to in the past. I worked on a WPF kiosk app, that they obviously used Expression Blend to generate a bunch of animations. They had this thing where you had a bunch of tiles on the screen, and when you picked one, it got bigger. The others got smaller. They moved around a bit. Somebody had gone into Expression Blend and defined individual animations for all these things. And of course, you had to have a dozen different variations of, because there were 12 different tiles. So when each tile got bigger, the others got smaller and moved to unique places around the screen. This was pages and pages and pages of XAML animation, all of which I threw out and replaced with a custom panel, which to me was the obvious way to go. And it took about a day and a half of work. They had slotted about 2 weeks of work for me on this. I was finished in a day and a half with a custom panel that applied all the animations in code that were needed. It's relying on XAML generation tools and other tools can be very dangerous.
Unless you really know what's happening.
Unless
right?
you know what's happening. And you have to learn how to write it by hand first, and you have to know the right way to do things. And
you kind of allude to an interesting point that I've never really got a good satisfying answer to, which is the when do I use XAML and when do I use code? Because initially when this was introduced, there was almost this sense of I should feel guilty or bad if I somehow have to drop into code behind. And like, you should be able to do these amazing things in XAML. So you just said a custom panel. Did you write code behind to help do that?
That's custom panels are written entirely in code. There's no XAML involved with that. Another thing I've seen is that programmers no longer, who have been working with WPF for a while, no longer know how to create a button in code. And this to me is, if you've lost that skill, there's something wrong.
So what is the responsibility of XAML and what is the responsibility of code behind? Because as we move towards...
I use XAML a lot, and in one sense, I'm a XAML fiend. I like doing things in XAML that nobody else has done in XAML. I did a complete clock application in XAML, which it was very, very hard because XAML can't perform arithmetic, and I needed to perform arithmetic.
And you just did this as an exercise?
Yeah, I did a blog post about it, and I did it I put it in my book, and basically, because XAML itself can't do arithmetic, I use transform groups to perform arithmetic. So I basically set up groups of transforms, and when you set up a group of transforms, they multiply by each other, and a bunch of data bindings, and the whole thing was done in XAML. That's really a macho programming thing, though. You know, I like the way XAML mimics the layout structure of a window. And I try to do as much in XAML as I can with that layout and with data bindings. You need code for event handling. But there are cases where it just makes more sense to define an animation in code and apply it. And you learn which way to go after years of experience. And there's no right, because this is programming, because right. this is part art as well as engineering.
Yeah,
there
true.
Is no right answer as well.
Would you say that it's a good idea to create custom controls in code and then express them as XAML? That's the real power?
There is a very popular technique, both in WPF and Silverlight, of a user control, which is you derive from user control, and it's basically a layout of other controls and elements that define the visual appearance of the control. That is a very useful technique. On the other hand, I've done things like if you want to extend a scroll bar, if you want to add a couple more properties to a scroll bar, it's good to do that in code and then define the visual appearance with a template. Again, in XAML. Anything that's very visual is proper to do in XAML.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman from another Parallel Universe. Got to tell you about some of our things our sponsors are doing. They make this free podcast possible. If you're developing a new line of business application, you've probably tried the latest version of Silverlight. Now you can get even better results by combining the functionality in Silverlight 4 beta with some of the richness of the third-party controls from our friends at Telerik. They're the first vendors to offer native support for the Silverlight 4 beta and their RAD controls. They've got a new Silverlight 4 CTP suite of these controls. They let you tap into the framework's great potential. You get native right mouse click and all the new features of Silverlight. There's 38 controls that give you all these features. You can start building those compelling line of business applications right away. I encourage you to check those products out at Telerik.com/Silverlight. And, thank Telerik for supporting .NET Rocks, supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page at facebook.com/Telerik. Now back to the show.
So speaking to things that are proper and correct, as we move into Windows Phone 7, I'm starting to realize that they really are going to hold us to this aesthetic. Before, you could make green buttons and purple backgrounds and nobody said anything.
Well, there is one good reason for imposing a particular aesthetic on the phone, and it is this. Phones are very sensitive to battery life. You want to extend that battery as much as possible. These phones are using OLED technology, organic LEDs, mm-hmm. I don't think they're actually made from living things. I don't know. But what, one of the things about OLEDs is that they have longer, they don't use as much power as conventional LEDs, but only if the screen is very dark. If the screen is very light, they will use more power than a conventional LED. If the screen is very dark, they will use a lot less power. So this, what is the general rule when our aesthetics follows from our technology limitations?
Yeah.
But this is why the aesthetic is on the phone is very dark backgrounds with this light spindly text.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that this Metro thing that they've created, it also takes advantage of, we realize that there are things off screen, and this might be a little bit obtuse, but, you know, Jakob Nielsen said that users will never scroll. And I think what was underlying that, because Jakob Nielsen was a usability engineer, was that users cannot conceive of objects off screen, right? Just like babies for a very long time never understand that there are objects when you take it out of their sight of vision. But now, fast forward, the entire world has matured. They're saying that the phone is a window on a larger panorama.
There's an interesting analogy. When motion pictures were first created, people thought that audiences wouldn't follow cuts. They wouldn't be able to understand when the movie cut between two different scenes that they were actually happening simultaneously. And of course, audiences picked this up right away. They do have a layout on the phone that implies horizontal scrolling because things go off to the side. And, it's very interesting, partially because it's the whole look of Windows Phone is so unlike any other smartphone in the market. It's really going to distinguish itself in that aspect as well.
What do you think about the decision for them to make it only managed code?
I think that's an excellent decision. I am very much in favor of managed code. That may sound odd from somebody
say,
who started off in assembly language.
This is the part where I say, you of all people.
Me of all people. I started off with, I really started off with Fortran, but I spent a lot of time with assembly language on the 8080 and the Z80 and the 8086. I spent a lot of time with C. Because of my assembly language background, I was very good with pointers in C. But I have, even though I was a little reluctant, skeptical, I have come around to see the wisdom of managed code. There are certain types of errors, certain types of common bugs that are just impossible in managed code. And to me, this is the most important aspect of it. The programs are a lot easier to get running, and a lot easier to debug, and they're just not as buggy as traditional programs. So this move to managed code is something that I am very much in favor of.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that when people say, well, I'm frustrated that they won't let me code in C++ or C on this phone, that is that rooted in fear? And I'm assuming fear that I will be unable to do something.
Partially. I heard a lot of this in the early days of .NET, that there were certain things people wanted to do, partially with string handling, because strings are immutable in .NET, and some certain kinds of string handling become very clumsy. There is a lot of reluctance among gaming developers to move to managed code because they have more of an argument. Because they're accustomed to getting very low down next to the hardware, and they are not accustomed to garbage collection. And garbage collection is a serious problem in games, because if you're going at a frame rate of 30 frames per second, if you are allocating from the local heap 30 times a second, there's going to be a garbage collection. And when there's a garbage collection, your game's going to stutter, and that's not a good thing. A lot of the move to managed code in games has been an awareness of the garbage collection problem. And a lot of the types of objects that you would normally be allocating 30 times a second during your game loop In XNA, a lot of these are structures rather than classes, so they don't get allocated from the local heap. But you still have to be aware of this problem, and you just have to avoid local heap allocations on a, and that'll help. That'll solve the garbage collection problem.
And couldn't you pre-allocate?
Yes, that's another technique. You can have a cache of objects that are ready for you and reuse them. Yes. Yes. There are numerous techniques to deal with this problem, but I can
understand why I'd be afraid.
Yes. It's something that game developers are nervous about and rightfully so. They're going to have to learn some new techniques.
So, if I want to learn how to program Windows Phone, then I'm going to buy the book. I'm going to buy the Petzold book.
Thank you.
Well, you
don't have to buy it, actually. This book is going to, the completed book will be available later this year as a free download. And, the first 150 pages that I've written are available now as a free download. If you go to my website, charlespetzold.com, on the homepage, you'll have links. There are links provided. There's also a link to the PDF file on the portal to the Windows Phone developer page, which is developer.windowsphone.com. Very important website to know about.
So it's free.
It's free. It's absolutely free.
Is this a book or a pamphlet?
It's a book. The excerpt that I finished in time for Mix is 150 pages.
That's an excerpt. So we're looking at 100. This is a real book.
This is going to be
with a big spine.
The contract says, yeah, a big spine, but virtually speaking, it's a download. A big giant PDF or XPS file. The contract calls for 400 pages.
That's a book.
Frankly, I think it's going to be, the original contract for programming Windows called for a book of about 400 pages. Uh-oh. And the first edition was more like 800. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see. I love writing books. I love, partially it's the process of building the book from nothing, from just words, but it's the challenges of organizing the material into a narrative that the reader can follow from beginning to end. Unfortunately, although in the past people used to read books like this, a lot of people tell me about their experience of reading programming Windows from cover to cover. Unfortunately, people don't do that much anymore, but it's still, I'm not sure I can write a book otherwise. And for a reader who jumps into it just to learn one little topic, I don't know.
Do you struggle with the concept? I mean, the writing a book is as much about you putting pen to paper as it is about effectively getting someone to absorb that information into their brain. And because of the way time operates, they have to do it in a fairly linear fashion. And they may be flipping around in the book, but by flipping around the book and reading chapters in a different order, they're simply reading a different book.
Yes. There is, I take a lot of time and thought to put my chapters in the right order. Each chapter builds on the chapter previously. I try to pace the introduction of materials so it doesn't overwhelm the reader. You also want to keep up the reader's interest. But there is, in learning programming, there is a point at which you need to start, and the knowledge is accumulated over a long period of time. And I like to mimic that process. It's a little odd doing it these days because I am well aware that a lot of programmers simply don't learn like that anymore. Mm-hmm. Partially it's because they don't have time. There are lots of new technologies you have to keep up with. And, it's not like back in the early 90s where every MS-DOS developer realized, I am going to need to learn Windows, and this is going to be something I'll be using for the next 10 or 20 years, and hence I can afford spending the time to learn it properly in a tutorial manner.
That's a really interesting point, because you're saying that people may be less interested in investing deeply in a technology if they can't trust that it's there tomorrow.
Exactly. And the technologies change so quickly, and there's so many of them. And our development tools have made it very easy. If you boot up Visual Studio, you can have a Silverlight or an XNA program running. Doesn't do much, but you can run it just by pressing F5.
Yeah. So how are you going to write this book? I haven't read the excerpt yet, but you have to assume a couple of things. You have to assume that reader A is a programmer, professional,
yes,
using Silverlight for years, and that reader B is a 19-year-old who's never programmed in his life.
I assume that the reader is a programmer. I have to do that.
All right.
I assume that the reader knows .NET and C Sharp. If not, I have a online book on my website called, this is a rather shorter book. It's called .NET Book Zero.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an introduction to .NET and C Sharp for the C or C++ programmer.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I can't do anything.
Okay.
I start off assuming the book's going to be both about Silverlight and XNA, which are the two programming interfaces on Windows Phone. And I start off I'm covering both of them. I start off assuming that the reader doesn't know either one.
That's what I want to know. So you're assuming that they don't know XAML, they don't know WPF, they don't know Silverlight.
If your readers haven't been here at Mix, they might have not have heard the exciting news about that Windows Phone will support both Silverlight and XNA. So Silverlight will be used mostly for what we think of as applications and utilities, calculators and anything with a list box will be Silverlight, whereas XNA is for games, 2D and 3D games.
And you're going to cover both of them?
I'm going to cover both of them.
So it's two books, effectively.
We had a discussion about this, whether it should really be two books rather than one book, because there will be programmers who will never learn XNA for the phone, and there will be programmers who will never learn Silverlight for the phone. I'd like to see programmers learn both. I think that if you're going to be a good Windows Phone programmer, you should know both. You should know when to use Silverlight. You should know when to use XNA. You can use some of the framework from XNA in your Silverlight app and vice versa visually. The two output paradigms are very different. So either your app is a Silverlight app or an XNA app.
Mm-hmm.
You can't mix them visually at this time. That may come sometime in the future. But they are very two different paradigms, and they are different enough so that you can jump back and forth between them without getting confused.
Really?
Yes.
And they're both in .NET. They share core libraries. If I'm going to open a file and run around in a I'm going to run around in isolated storage and read data. I'm using the same API as an XNA.
Absolutely.
And if I want to talk to the microphone and get the raw feed from the microphone.
Yes, there is an XNA classes to do that, and you can access those from your Silverlight app.
Mm-hmm. So I have to plead ignorance on XNA because I know a lot of people who've done it. I have friends who have put out XNA games, but I've never really sat down and looked at that. Can you give me a brief sense of what does an XNA application look like? How do I get things on the screen?
Okay. In an XNA app, you're dealing almost, let's stick to 2D at the moment.
Sure.
In an XNA app, you're dealing entirely with bitmaps, and they're called textures. Even your text is a bitmap. You go back to bitmap style text. And you have a method that you override called draw. And during this method, this draw method is called 30 times a second, which is the frame rate on the Windows Phone. On a PC, it would be called 60 times a second or 70 times a second. And it's you basically draw your entire screen at that point, all your bitmaps, right out to the screen. To prepare for that draw method, you have another method called update, where you perform all the calculations. These two methods are separated because of some timing issues if you can't quite keep up with the frame rate. But you're basically on a frame by frame basis. You're doing all your calculations for all the locations of all the little sprites on the screen. You're also polling for input during the update method. So it's very much drawing basic bitmaps and polling for input. Whereas in Silverlight, all your input comes through events, and you are, even though somewhere in the composition level, things are being redrawn at the screen refresh rate, you really just put them there once, and they stay there. It's a retain mode graphics system.
So if I'm spitting out this this entire screen, and I mean my knowledge of Windows graphics programming actually ended, I think, in the GDI days.
So both Silverlight and XNA are very different from GDI.
Okay, well, see, I was going to ask there that you're saying I'm thinking to myself as an old school programmer, like, am I double buffering? Does it handle it for me?
XNA is double buffered. Yes, you are writing to what's called a back buffer, and then that is updated to the screen, the actual screen.
So it's very much a raw, you have complete control of what's going on.
Yes, which is what game programmers like.
Okay. So, you know, for the person who wishes that they had C++, maybe they really just need to check out XNA.
Yeah. I have enjoyed XNA programming precisely because I've feel very, very low in the technological hierarchy.
And the book is going to include not just graphics and Silverlight and XNA, but is it going to also include some of the more services-based things? Are we going to be able to talk
It's interesting. There's a lot. There's a real web service orientation to the Windows Phone, and including Xbox Live. I am currently discussing with my publisher, who is Microsoft Press, about stuff that I won't put in the book. To allow other authors to give better treatment to it. And I am considering, I have not yet made the decision, but I am considering that the programs in my book will be very self-contained, and will not be using web services. Aside from, there's a location service that I just...
There's some ubiquitous services, intrinsic services that are part of the phone, right?
Yeah, well, location is considered to be a web service, but there's actual classes for location.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it does speak over the wire in some way.
Yeah, the location's interesting. It's called AGPS, which I believe means assisted GPS, and the phone is a GPS device, so it can get GPS information. But GPS is often slow. It takes a while to get the information. It's no good indoors. So they use other techniques to help out with GPS, including Wi-Fi. They try to figure out location from Wi-Fi, and they try to figure out location from cell towers. And you can choose whether you want fast location that's not so accurate or slow location that's very accurate. And GPS is considered slow but accurate.
Well, it definitely seems like an important topic to cover.
Yes.
But I see that programming Windows Phone 7 Series Network Edition is almost a whole book in itself.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I could cover cloud and OData and WCF I can see your challenge. Well, this has been fantastic, sir. I really appreciate you sitting down with me today.
Oh, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
So you can make sure that you check out Charles's blog at charlespetzold.com. You can download his book, and you can also go and buy Code and some of the other great books that he's bought, as well as checking out the Windows Phone Developer Portal at developer.windowsphone.com. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.